This is the 11KBW Employment Podcast, where every month, members of our employment team get together to chat about a recent case. I'm Christian Davis, and today I'm joined by Michael Lee. He's going to tell me about a recent case, Steele & Spencer Road, which concerns the enforceability of bonus clawbacks. Welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Christine. Glad to be joining you again after last time out talking about software management. This time I'm going to dazzle our listeners with executive searches. See how that goes.
You really get all of the sexiest topics.
Only the most glamorous.
So, Mike, I've heard that you were the victor in a battle between you, Andrew Smith, and Jamie Suskind to see who would do a podcast on this subject matter.
I didn't know that. It must be my legendary persuasive powers.
For a case that was an appeal from a decision in the Insolvency and Companies Court, it seems to have gained an awful lot of attraction amongst employment lawyers. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, an unusual route for an employment case, but I think it's for this reason. In the employment field, restraint of trade obviously comes up a lot, but the vast majority of decided cases look at the question of whether or not a clause that is in restraint of trade is enforceable. Relatively few cases look at the issue that this case considers, which is whether or not a particular provision is a restraint of trade or not in the first place. Actually, in my experience, it's something which I get asked to advise on, or at least think about quite regularly. So it's an interesting and important case for practitioners to have a look at in that area.
Could we take a step back then, Mike, and just remind ourselves what the restraint of trade doctrine is?
I suspect most listeners will be fairly familiar with the restraint of trade doctrine. In effect, a way in which the law recognises the public policy in promoting competition. And so across all areas of law, if there is a contractual clause or term that might prohibit competition, then the law has the ability to scrutinise whether it is reasonably necessary to protect both the interests of the parties and of the public. If it goes further than they reasonably require, then ordinarily the clause won't be enforceable in order to avoid the law clamping down on competition.
So it's a short point of law, this case, but are there any facts that our listeners need to know about?
Happily, I think I can probably get through those relatively briefly. What you need to know is probably this. The claimant, Mr. Steele, worked for a company called Amerta. His contract gave him access to a bonus scheme. There was a fairly standard bonus clawback provision, which meant that if he left or resigned or was given notice of termination within 3 months of receiving it, he had to pay it back.
So not a particularly unusual contractual provision?
Not at all. Very common. And that's probably why the case is of such interest to employment lawyers. What I would say, a fact that is worth noting, is this. The bonus was chunky relative to his basic pay. His bonus for 2022 that he received in January was $187,500, almost three times his basic salary of $65,000. So when he gave notice a month later and Amerta issued a statutory demand, it was undoubtedly a big sum for him in the context of his pay.
And can you just explain what a statutory demand is, Mike?
In very broad terms, it's a demand for a debt. And so it's a procedure by which here Amerta said, Mr. Steele, we want our £187,500 back, please. He applied to set that debt aside, and that came before the Insolvency and Companies Court.
And what were his arguments?
Primarily, he was arguing that the clawback provision was a restraint of trade. Now, I think it's important to spell out how that comes before the court in this context. All you have to do to set aside the demand is show an arguable basis for resisting it. So what you're looking at is more or less a summary judgment type application. He's saying, I've got an arguable basis, this is an unenforceable restraint of trade. The court considers whether he does or not. And in fact, Judge Mullen in that ICC says, I don't think that this is even an arguable restraint of trade, and away you go. That's what came before Mrs. Justice Bacon on appeal from the ICC.
And so this was, as you say, Mike, it was an appeal from the Insolvency and Companies Court. So it's an appellate decision, but it's heard in the High Court. And so it doesn't have the same status that a Court of Appeal decision would have had.
So in future, it would be very unlikely to be anything other than binding on another High Court judge, but it doesn't decide anything at a level of above that.
What were the grounds of appeal?
Relatively short and simple, they can be expressed in this way. The judge at first instance was wrong to hold that the clause was not a restraint of trade. So if that was right, what would follow would be that there'd have to be further consideration of other issues, such as whether or not it was reasonable and therefore enforceable. But straight and simple issue on appeal, was the judge right to say this was not a restraint of trade or not? It broke down with a little more complexity than that, but I think for present purposes, there's no need to delve much further.
The appellant had run a penalty clause argument at first instance, but didn't pursue that on appeal. Do you have any idea why that would have been?
Obviously, you never know exactly why someone has done or not done something, but looking at the facts of this, a penalty clause argument would have seemed to me a very ambitious one to run, because this wasn't a case where Mr. Steele was being alleged to or had in fact breached his contract by leaving. He was entitled to give notice and leave, so there was no anterior breach, which would be what would be required for the penalty clause doctrine to bite. A good point though, Christian. I think it's worth us coming back to that issue when we talk later perhaps about the wider practical significance of this case and how it might turn out on other facts.
Before we look at the outcome of this case in a bit more detail, why do you think the outcome might be significant?
I think just picking up on what I said at the outset, the restraint of trade doctrine requires a court to decide two questions. First, is the provision a restraint of trade? Second, if it is, does it go any further than the parties in the public interest reasonably require? In the employment sphere, most of these cases concern restrictive covenants, which everyone knows are a restraint of trade. And so question one is often not considered by the court in the first place. However, there are a whole host of other employment provisions, of which a bonus clawback is one, where the position is much less clear and the court does need to consider, is this a restraint of trade at all? Now, whilst that comes up quite a lot in practice, there's actually not very much authority on it. And that's why I think this case it is of real interest, because it examines that first question in a lot of detail and summarizes the past authorities in a way that's not been done for some time.
Got it. So it's a rare case about the first question, whether it is a restraint of trade at all, rather than the more common type of case as to whether an existing restraint of trade is enforceable.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd go even further than that. Another reason why it's particularly important is because it asks that question in the context of a bonus clawback, which is a very common provision in a whole host of contracts of employment across a wide range of industries and sectors. So it's particularly relevant for that reason too.
So can you take us through the reasoning of Mrs. Justice Bacon in a bit more detail?
Absolutely. As I said, Mrs. Justice Bacon came to the conclusion that the bonus clawback in this case was not a restraint of trade. Worth breaking down why she came to that decision. The first thing she did was consider a relatively recent Court of Appeal decision, albeit in the commercial context of quantum actuarial and quantum advisory, which makes the point that this issue is in effect a fact-sensitive one. The central question is whether the practical effect of a clause hampers freedom to trade. That's an issue of substance, not form, but there's no precise or exhaustive test for deciding if it's met. That was the context in which she came to consider this case.
And how did she apply those principles to this case?
I think to best understand that, it's worth looking at how she considered two different types of contractual provision. The first is a clause that requires an employee to repay, say, a bonus or a training fee if the employee joins a competitor within a certain period after leaving employment. That, the judge recognised, based on a well-established line of authority, is a restraint of trade, because even though it doesn't say in terms, employee, you shall not join a competitor, the effect of it is such that you lose a benefit if you do join the competitor. It's what's known often as an indirect restraint of trade, but a restraint of trade nevertheless.
But the clause in this case was different.
Absolutely. As you say, the clause here was different. The clause in issue in this case, as the judge recognised, was one that disincentivised Mr. Steele from resigning. He had to pay quite a significant financial penalty to do so within a set period of time. But what it did not do was impose any restriction on what he did once he had left. Once he'd left, he could go and work for whoever he wanted. And based on authority, the judge held that a clawback provision that doesn't restrict what you do after you have left, it only disincentivizes you from leaving, is not a restraint of trade.
So the provision is more concerned with incentivizing him to stay with his current employer rather than preventing him from going to work for a competitor of that employer.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one way of looking at it. Rather than describing it as a disincentive to leave, you could look at it as an incentive to stay. Either way, what it doesn't do is restrict freedom after you have left. After you've left, you can do what you want once you've paid up.
So that's a helpful explanation of what the judgment decided. What do you think the practical consequences of it are?
Good question. I think the most important one is probably this. In general terms, employers can operate on at least a starting assumption that a clawback provision of this type that requires an employee to repay a bonus or a training fee if they leave within X period will ordinarily not be a restraint of trade. The result of that is that it will be enforceable and the employee will be required to pay up. The employer doesn't have to show that it's reasonable or that it goes no further than is reasonably necessary because the doctrine just doesn't apply.
And what about from the employee's perspective?
I think very much the other side of the same coin. Employees are going to have to operate, at least on the basis of this authority, on the assumption that a clause such as this will be binding. So if they leave within the restricted period, they're going to have to forego the benefit. I think an important point from an employee's perspective, as you and I both know, and as will be familiar to most of those listening, only the absolutely most senior employees have any realistic bargaining power when it comes to signing contracts like this. In, say, 95% of cases, the chances of an employee being able to negotiate his or her way out of a clause like this are slim to none. The clause is going to be there. They're going to have to assume it's enforceable. So, in effect, if they want to leave, they're going to have to pay up.
And so is this carte blanche for employers to impose onerous bonus clawback provisions on all of their employees?
No, I don't think it is carte blanche. I think that would go far too far. I answered your question about practical consequences in fairly general terms. There's at least two important caveats to that, I think, which need to be broken down. The first is this. This judgment recognises the possibility that there might be cases where a clause like this, but a different clause like this, might be something that could attract the restraint of trade doctrine.
What would those circumstances be?
Well, it's deliciously vague on when the line might be crossed, I think, Christian, but the general idea is that there might be a case where the severity of the consequences are so severe for the employee, or looked at another way, so out of proportion with the benefit, that it might be said that the disincentive is so strong that it is actually a restraint of trade nevertheless. Now, I think it's let's be very clear, that is not going to be an easy argument to run. We are looking here, as I said, at a clause that required Mr. Steele to repay a bonus three times his basic pay, and that didn't even cross the summary judgment threshold.
Was the fact that Mr. Steele only had to remain in employment for 3 months after receiving his bonus relevant in this case?
Definitely. It looms large. One can see when one reads the decision, in the first instance decision in particular, it weighed on the judge's mind. He saw it as a relatively minor impediment on what the employee's ability to do what he wanted. Let's say it had been 3 years instead of 3 months. Could the outcome have been different? I'm not saying it would have been, but it might have been. I would totally agree.
What other factual circumstances may enable an employee to say that a clause is a restraint of trade?
It's difficult to say, to be honest. It's a line that's going to have to be drawn on a case-by-case basis, depending on the facts. What I would say is that, at first instance, Judge Mullen gave the example of a case where, in fact, the bonus wasn't really a bonus at all. It was just a way of describing someone's basic pay. And if you were actually having to forego what was your basic pay, your salary, again, one gets the impression that Judge Mullen might have looked at this case a bit differently. So that could be another example. But again, you'll see here, we're dealing with fairly extreme cases. I think the real problem is this for the employee. At the point of signing the contract, or perhaps more importantly, at the time of resigning, how are you going to be confident in anything other than the most extreme case that you're going to be able to persuade a court that this is a restraint of trade? And absent that confidence, do you want to embark upon litigation? That's why I think overall this is a strong win for employers.
You mentioned at the outset that there are two questions when dealing with a restraint of trade case. The first question is whether the clause in question is a restraint at all, and the second is whether that restraint is reasonable. Yeah. It sounds like some of the factors that you're talking about here could potentially be thought to go to the question of reasonableness. They're the kinds of questions that employment lawyers think about when they're looking at whether a non-compete is enforceable. The kind of 3 months versus 3 years sorts of questions.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And it's an interesting one because one of the things actually that was run by Mr. Steele on appeal was that the judge had confused those two questions. So he went as far to say on appeal that the judge, in looking at the period of 3 months, was looking at it from an enforceability perspective rather than logically prior question. No, said Mrs. Justice Bacon, that's not what he was doing at all. And she recognised exactly the point you just made, which is that there's undoubtedly in some cases going to be an overlap between some factors that are relevant to both of those. The court's perfectly entitled to look at those when looking at question one and question two.
You mentioned a second caveat, Mike. I'm not sure if this is what you were going to say, but to me it seems the fact that this is a High Court decision may limit its significance.
Yeah, I don't know if I go quite so far as to say limit its significance, but I think it's definitely worth people having in mind that it might not be the last word. That's the way that I would look at it. I said there's been not much authority on this area, and that's right. There's been even less authority in this area at the Court of Appeal level. Stepping back, there's undoubtedly, to my mind, a logical distinction between a clause that seeks to disincentivize someone from leaving, or as you put it, incentivize them to stay, and one that seeks to disincentivize the employee post-termination from engaging in competitive activity. But does that logical distinction automatically have the result here that one is a restraint of trade and one isn't? I can see that there's scope for further debate on that. I'm not saying one is right or wrong, but there's scope for further debate to my mind.
And you mentioned earlier, Mike, that the judgment indicates that more severe provisions may attract the restraint of trade doctrine, but it's not clear from this judgment precisely what the theoretical footing for that would be.
Very good point again. I completely agree. And that's why I do wonder if there's potential for further litigation around the edges of this issue. If one starts from the position that disincentivizing someone from leaving or incentivizing them to stay with a clause of this type isn't a restraint of trade, why does it become a restraint of trade just because you change what the consequences are? I'm not saying that that is definitely wrong, but it's equally something which, to my mind, is ripe for further debate. The cases aren't all one way on this. There's a case in a more commercial context of a business purchase agreement called 2020 London, in which Mr. Donaldson QC, sitting as a deputy judge, who allowed an issue to go to trial on the enforceability of a provision requiring consideration for a business purchase to be repaid within 3 years if someone left. Mr. Justice Bacon distinguished that on the basis it was a different type of commercial contract. That might be right. It might also show a different fundamental starting point for the treatment of clauses of this type, I think.
Okay, so we should watch this space for any future Court of Appeal decisions in this area.
Absolutely. I can well see this going to the Court of Appeal at some point, particularly given how prevalent these types of clause are in many employment spheres, their day-to-day contracts. I would just raise another potential point on appeal, which is more specific to the facts of this case. Mrs. Justice Bacon held that the judge had been correct here not to look at the impact of the clawback in light of the 3-month notice period and a 13-week post-termination restraint on competition. What that meant, of course, was that in effect, there was a restraint on competing in one way or another for 9 months after this payment was received. She said, you don't need to look at those issues. It's okay, just look at this clause. Again, I'm not saying that that is wrong, but equally, I'm not sure that it's definitely right either, and I can see scope for further debate.
I agree. There could be a case for looking at these types of provisions cumulatively rather than individually.
Exactly. When one looks at the starting principle of a restraint of trade case in the Court of Appeal Authority, it says, look at these cases in the round. It's about substance, not form. Is it therefore definitely right to isolate just one clause from a contract and look at that? I can see the debate.
We touched on penalty clauses earlier. Is that something that employment lawyers need to still be conscious about in these contexts?
Absolutely. The fact that it wasn't particularly relevant here does not mean that the issue can be disregarded in a different type of case. It entirely depends on the wording of the provision. Let's say you had a contract clause which required the employee not to do X, and if you do X, you will have to repay Y. That is a clause which might well engage the penalty clause doctrine, and therefore it's not something that employment lawyers can just take their eyes off the ball on altogether. It just wasn't especially relevant on the facts of this case.
So if you were acting for an employer, you would want to make the clawback provision not contingent on a breach of contract?
Absolutely. The key issue is to avoid drafting a clause in a way that makes a repayment contingent upon a breach in very broad terms. And that's if you want to avoid the penalty doctrine applying, what you need to do.
So to wrap up, Mike, what is your key takeaway for our listeners?
I'm going to take your requests for one and I'm going to reward it with three. First, a provision that requires an employee to repay or forego a benefit in the event of them leaving is likely to be enforceable and not a restraint of trade. Two, though, that will depend on the factual circumstances, and there may be extreme cases in which the doctrine will be engaged and people need to be wary of that. And point three, as we've discussed, it's a field in which there's actually not a great deal of authority, so people shouldn't automatically assume that this is the last word.
That was Michael Lee talking to me, Christian Davis, about Steele and Spencer Rhodes. The podcast is produced by our own Hannah Slarks. You can find the 11KBW Employment Podcast on all the usual podcast apps. You can also email us at employmentpodcast@11kbw.com.